with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good afternoon, everyone, or wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. And if you've been listening to this show for a while, you know exactly what that means. But if you're tuning in for the very first time, I will say that I am a firm believer that we all come into this world with everything that we need as far as our gifts, our graces, our personalities, our strengths, our likes, our dislikes, and so forth. Like I said, everything that we need. And most of the time that we're unaware of just exactly what we have or what we have to offer or who we are. And therefore, to go back in and to reclaim our authentic selves, and how do we live that out in today's world? Well, I'm very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. Welcome to October. Here we are, October 2nd. Oh my gosh, it was almost just like we just got into September. We had Labor Day and so forth, and now we're in October, which is coming into my favorite time of the year, fall and winter. So really enjoying the seasons change and just the magnificent colors that are on display throughout nature. So I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, visit me on my website at www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. Again, it's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show today, I invite you to call in. That number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And these broadcasts are also podcasted, just in case you want to go back and listen to them again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. And in a little while, after the break, I will be taking your phone calls because I really like to hear from you on today's subject, blessing the liminal space between us. Well, I trust your season of autumn is going well, and it is off to a very, very good start, and I wish you the very best throughout the months of October, November, December, and so forth. So let's begin this afternoon with a quick question. Just by a show of hands, there in the comfort of your own home or office or wherever you may be, how many of you have ever gone through some sort of transition? How many of you have ever gone through some sort of transition? Well, all of us have. Now, we may not have had similar reactions to what we've gone through, but we've all have gone through various transitions in our lives. For example, just simply by getting older and facing new challenges throughout our lifespan, or let's say challenges such as graduation or graduations. Maybe some of you have had changes in jobs or careers. Maybe some of you have had, you know, the opportunities to move from one place to another because of employment or otherwise. And, you know, many of us have made the transition from being single to being married or having a life partner. And when we go through such transitions, we often find ourselves in a kind of limbo or a liminal space, in which there may be a great deal of anxiety, uncertainty, and especially the unfamiliar. Now, if you want a basic textbook definition of what in the world is a liminal space, well, it is literally the time we find ourselves, the time between what was and the next. It is a place of transition. It's a place of waiting and not knowing. And some people describe it as being at a threshold of waiting and not knowing what to do with our next, what's coming our way and so forth. And these thresholds are everywhere in life and they are inevitable. And each liminal space ushers in a new chapter of our lives and holds varying degrees of disruption as well as uncertainty. And that unnerves a lot of people. However, there are many lessons that we can learn being in this liminal space. We don't really necessarily have to look at them as something negative. So basically, either liminality or liminal space, both take the concept of a threshold and apply it to the times of our transitions or ambiguity or just simply waiting. And in spiritual terms, it is often becomes a time of growth. It becomes a time of learning and spiritual transformation. That is, if we embrace the opportunity. And if would never have been in any kind of liminal space, we would stop growing. We would stop being challenged, and thus we would stop developing our fullest potential. And the liminal space is often looked at as, you know, a very uncomfortable time, or as like say a dark night of the soul, and we're just wondering, when is this going to end? When are we going to get through this? When can we get on with our lives? But we find that there are very, very valuable lessons in this transitional piece. One of my favorite writers is Thomas Merton. He's a Trappist, he was a Trappist monk who lived during the early to mid 1900s. And he wrote such books such as The Seven Story Mountain, which I have to recommend. If you've never read that, please purchase it and read it. It is definitely a gem. And his New Seeds of Contemplation. Well, in another book, I found a great quote of his. It comes from his book entitled Thoughts in Solitude. And he wrote this back in around 1958, Thoughts in Solitude. And Merton wrote perhaps his most famous saying or more famous, a poem, a story regarding the uncertainty of being in a liminal space, as well as the resiliency needed to remain true to his own calling. And this is how the poem goes. He goes, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I am going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I am following your will doesn't mean that I'm actually doing so. But I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadows of death. I will not fear, for yes, you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my perils alone." Well, again, liminal space is that time between the what was in our lives and the next, or what's coming up or coming towards us. It is this place of transition and waiting, and it just has this sense of uncertainty to it. And if there ever was a time when people display a sense of directionlessness or anxiety-driven or disruption of a lack of sense of purpose and direction in life, it's within the contemporary times which we live. And despite that age-old wisdom that material things just do not satisfy or guarantee happiness, society, nevertheless, plunges, shall we say, headfirst into the pit of despair and emptiness and pain. And they wonder why they keep doing it again and again. And we can certainly get caught up into that. You know, it just takes away our focus, or we can be so consumed with the unknown that we feel like we need to control the future for, you know, the sake of our own peace and happiness. Well, I can tell you firsthand that from a counseling therapist's perspective, it appears that not only are people uncomfortable with uncertainty, but also they're taught how to live in uncertain times. And some get that better than others. There are some who just are never taught those lessons. And so the thought of the uncertainty just, for lack of a better phrase, just unnerves a lot of people. They just, start to unravel, and then just the anxiety goes through the roof. And yet a pattern emerges as we seem to move from one liminal space to another. Well, originating from the Latin word limens, being in that liminal space means to lose everything that you have come to trust, everything that you have come to understand, everything that you have come to know, and uncertain about what to do next. And as I said, it's as if we're standing at a threshold and feeling as though we are at a in-between state. And again, for many people, that just doesn't sit well. For when many people that they are in a state of uncertainty, or they just simply do not know which way to go, I often tell people that this place that they're in is a very good place to be. And everything, although everything in us may resist this, and we hate that, and we get uncomfortable with that, it is nonetheless a place that we need to be in our lives. It's a place or a state which no longer serves us, that keeps us from growing. And we often want to stay in that very comfortable place in our lives where we are not challenged. And we can just simply say to the rest of the world, no, I'm good. I'm content. I'm fine. Just leave me alone. And again, when we say things like that, we really stop growing. We really stop, facing challenges in our lives. And one thing that never fully develops in us is a sense of resiliency. So we need to be able to develop resiliency, and in order to do that, we need to face uncertain times. We need to face situations in which we just simply may not know what to do, or we're told to wait. Okay. So unfortunately, many people misunderstand this liminal space, because we tend to ask ourselves, what did I do wrong? Or did I take a wrong turn somewhere? What's going on here? It just doesn't make sense. Nothing is familiar. I just can't make heads or tails about it, or whatever else we want to tell ourselves. But let's think about it this way. Let's say that perhaps you've done everything right. And perhaps you've outgrown, let's say, the previous spaces or the places, or outgrown the old ways of looking at things. And perhaps everything that has happened in your life, the decisions that you've made, the sacrifices, the mistakes, the joys, the celebrations, everything have brought you to this very exact moment. Okay. And that's just quite a different way of looking at life in general, that we're not looking at it in negative terms. But we're just looking at even the times which we really struggle and the times which we celebrate actually have created some form of transformation in us. And we often look back on our lives and we just say, well, if I would have chosen something else, or if I would have did this at that time, I wonder how my life would turn out. Well, that might make for a good story or a good movie, but that's just simply not the case. We don't get do-overs, more or less. But in the same vein, we are definitely, not I'll put it to you this way, that we are not the end-all be-all of our choices. Okay, that there is so much more to us than that. And when we are able to fully understand this about ourselves and everything that has brought us to each and every moment, it is then easy to live in gratitude. And this includes even the most traumatic experiences that we face in life. And for the most part, trauma is not a catastrophic event, but rather trauma is an after effect of a perceived or real life-threatening situation that measures really our ability to survive and thrive in everyday life. And when we become overwhelmed with circumstances, or if we just are overwhelmed with our resiliency, that's when something can be very, very traumatic. And to differentiate trauma, we might experience, shall we say, life-threatening events versus more transitional events. You know, trauma we might experience from, shall we say, like significant life transitions. And a researcher who's done great work in this area, Bessel van der Kolk, he categorizes trauma into two categories. He likes to call it a big T and little T trauma. And this is what he means by that. He says the big T trauma can be understood as such experiences as war or life-threatening illnesses or violence or physical, sexual, and or emotional abuse or natural disasters, and et cetera, and so on and so on. And with such experiences, there is an element of vulnerability to our personal safety and our emotional well-being. And that's why he labels such experiences as big T trauma. However, the little T traumas fall into a context of everyday or more of like a transitional experiences, such as being promoted or fired at work, or moving to another city, or beginning or finishing school, or what about changes in the family from the births to loved ones who are passing away. Even good things such as getting married can kick up a sense of, you know, uncertainty, you know, whether I'm doing the right thing or not. And we find ourselves in that liminal space of a little T trauma, which can be just as overwhelming. And although there's not an element of threat to our personal safety per se, these little T traumas have the potential to be just as overwhelming as big T traumas, especially if our unresolved traumatic life issues, shall we say, have been accumulating over time, where different things we go to or go through, I should say, that we've never fully worked through or we've never fully grieved. And unbeknownst to us, they start to build up. And it doesn't take much, but yet one more transition or a very big T trauma comes our way. And we can be thoroughly exhausted in our resiliency and overwhelmed. And then we find that our trauma is just layered with such experiences and loss. Now, from a psychosocial viewpoint, there is a huge difference between big T trauma that results from, let's say, natural disasters, you know, such as fires, floods, earthquakes, and so forth, versus experiences that have the potential to produce characteristics of both big T and little T trauma simultaneously. And such experiences would include, let's say, a direct physical or emotional or psychological or even spiritual harm that is the result of, let's say, the malicious intent of others. For example, something that I have studied quite a bit and just fueled a major part in my life of just integrating spirituality and mental health issues are, within hate crimes and genocide. And, just going down through history and just looking at, such phenomena, there are also components of justice and accountability within hate crimes and genocide. And, as I started understanding just the distinct layers of how this gets played out throughout history, we often find that people responsible for inflicting harm against others that when they're not held accountable, or that, let's say, systems that continue to oppress people are not corrected, again, traumatized people are more likely to collapse from these additional layers of, let's say, internalized humiliation or disgrace, a shame or a ridicule, and so forth. And yet, what makes matters worse is that these physical, emotional, and spiritual wounds often remain infected when others are suffering similar pain and exploitation. In fact, when such atrocities and suffering and oppression continue to be met with silent indifference or willful disregard, this is where societies often become numb to the fact that they encourage convenient justification of oppressed systems, you know, generation after generation after generation. So, in other words, when crimes against humanity are left unchecked, they often serve to further cement trauma, and they also send a dangerous message to other societies that such crimes can be committed in the future without consequence. And ironically here, the potential is that crimes against humanity can produce a trauma which not only stains the soul, but also blindsides future generations with the emotional, psychological, physical, and spiritual baggage of the past. And yet, I usually take this one step deeper. I started asking the question, yet what effect does trauma have on us as souls? See, most of the time we talk about the symptoms of grief and trauma in the language of physical and or emotional terms. But furthermore, if the spiritual component is explored in terms of rebuilding faith and philosophical systems that are challenged by a loss, the soul can often get lost in the language of religion. And for example, that's what I mean. On one hand, it's good to alleviate symptoms. And I have many people who just, schedule appointments with me to say, look, I just want to feel better. I just want to eat better. I just want to be able to sleep better. I want to be in healthier relationships. Yet, on the other hand, what if we embrace our true selves as soul and begin to transform the energy of our traumatic experiences through the voice of the soul? And this is where things start to get a little interesting, because in order to understand ourselves as soul, we must first suspend our logical linear thinking, especially when it comes to being in a liminal space, when it doesn't make sense, when we don't know what's happening, when we have more questions than we have answers. But that doesn't mean that we're without a voice. It doesn't mean that we are without a soul. Because if we are able to really pay attention to what's going on in this liminal space, we'll find that the voice of our souls come out loud and clear. Well, ever since the Age of Enlightenment, back in the late 1600s, 1700s, and so forth, people have been taught to verify experiences through the senses. You know, how much does it weigh, or what does it look like, or is this kind of behavior predictable, or can we place its role in our finite human understanding? Yet our souls simply do not play by these rules, and it can never be grasped from a linear understanding of the mind. And, you know, it's just something that never has been and it never will be. Still, those who are looking for some sort of empirical evidence of the soul believe that unless the soul can be verified by this temporal template, then, you know, the soul just simply does not exist. Well, in fact, another important aspect when it comes to understanding trauma's effect on a soul is that a person's soul is not mortal. The soul is the only thing that lives on after our hearts stop beating and the brain waves cease. The soul lives on eternally in other dimensions and timelessness in a location we are told is heaven, where the fullness of God exists in an unfathomable glory, majesty, and splendor. But for now, let's get back to being in a liminal space and displaying resiliency. Hans Seele, He died back in 1982. He was an endocrinologist who first coined the term stress. And he defined stress as the non-specific response of the body to any demand for change. And I believe it was like 1974, 1973, somewhere around there, where he just first coined the term stress. And his theory focused on the physiological or biological changes that are produced when a person simply responds to his or her environment. In other words, stress is our body's way of responding to a threat or a challenge. For example, when confronted with a challenge, we definitely go into our sympathetic nervous system, and it activates our fight or flight response. And typically, once the threat or a challenge has passed, the parasympathetic nervous system kicks in and eventually returns our physiological reaction to some normal state of homeostasis. We are calm. We can relax now. Our breathing, you know, is no longer shallow. We feel better. Okay. Well, initially, Seeley conducted his experiments on laboratory animals to determine how they would react to acute physical and emotional negative stimuli. You know, he used things such as blaring light or deafening noise, extreme temperatures of heat or cold. He used starvation and perpetual confusion or frustration and so forth. And, of course, this was back in the day that you could abuse those animals, and it didn't really have the repercussions that it would, you know, currently. But as a result, all the animals exhibited similar physical changes, such as stomach ulcerations or shrinkage of the lymphoid tissues or an enlargement of the adrenals. Some animals suffered heart attacks or strokes, etc., etc. And inevitably, Seeley became convinced that similar prolonged negative stimulus had the potential to cause the same disease, these same reactions in human beings. I mean, call it stress or compassion fatigue or burnout or whatever. Our reaction to any stress-filled event leads us toward a, as he coined, a three-stage bodily response. And it has the potential to overwhelm our well-being, especially if we find ourselves in this liminal space or a transitional period in our lives. And as I said, Seeley coined not only stress, but he also coined this model. He called it the general adaptation syndrome, which actually contains three distinct phases that describe our physiological response to stress. The first stage, he says, is the alarm stage. And as we perceive a stressor, our body reacts with a fight or flight response, and our sympathetic nervous system activates the body's resources in order to meet the threat or danger. And when a mind identifies the stressor as a threat or danger to our well-being, it immediately activates this fight or flight response, and it releases stress hormones such as adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol. Well, next, he would call it the resistance stage, that as our bodies attempt to return to, return the physiological functions to normal levels, we still remain on alert against whatever stressor is coming up in our lives. However, when a stressor persists, our body's defenses become weaker. And more of our energy needs to be allocated in order to repair, let's say, damaged muscle tissues or to lower the production of the stress hormones. And although the body has shifted into the second phase of stress response, it's simply not as strong as it was during, let's say, the initial response or the alarm stage. Well, finally, he says, if we get to the last stage, he calls it the exhaustion stage, that if the stressor continues beyond our capacity, our body's resources become exhausted. And this is when we become susceptible to, let's say, illnesses, disease, even death. In other words, the body begins to lose its ability to combat the stressors and reduce their harmful impact because the adaptive energy has all been drained. And at this stage, you know, eventually leads people to then experience, let's say, the emotional burnout or compassion fatigue in their everyday work. Well, today, research on the physiological factors associated with stress have evolved beyond Seeley's fight or flight phenomena. In fact, one researcher, Braca, he expanded Seeley's understanding to include the stages of freeze, fight, flight, and faint. For example, he says the freeze. When, let's say, you're walking along a trail and you hear a rattling noise, and you look down, but you may not see the snake hiding in the grass. Your first response is to freeze, because in our minds, the amygdala detects an attack, and it signals to the rest, to the brainstem, to inhibit movement. We just simply freeze. And this reaction happens in a flash, you know, automatically and beyond our conscious control. We don't have time to think. We just react. And we shift into a state of vigilance against any attacks and or look for a means of escape. And at this stage, he says, this is where the body is primed for this fight or flight, and although this may not be the next course of action. So let's say, you know, we hear the snake, the rattling continue. We don't see the snake. But now let's say we do see the snake and the snake is slithering toward us. And we quickly look for ways to remove ourselves from this threat, or we're now in the flight syndrome there. And we back away or we run away. And then if we have no means of escape from the snake, we then quickly move into, let's say, the fight. And we will perhaps pick up a stick and we fight. That is like pushing the snake away to avoid becoming bitten and thus staying alive. But then Braca takes it even one step further. And he says, but if there is no fight or flight, and if both of these are futile, we may be gripped with terror to the point of shutting down and dropping to the floor, hence fainting. Actually, opossums actually do this quite well, in a sense. Their bodies go into survival mode, and their heart rate decreases, and it just slows growth. And in a sense, there's a physical paralysis, and if things get worse, we may faint in hopes that our so-called simulated death will prevent our actual death. Well, I would really love to hear your heart on the liminal spaces that you have found yourself in. So again, if you would like to call in and be part of the show, this number is 888-627-6008. 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck. I'll be back with you in about 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, just want to briefly mention to you about next week's show, Friday at 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And I entitled this broadcast, Vaya con Dios, Go with God. And just something that I just wanted to share with the audience that I'll be doing in full detail next week. But just wanted to share with you a little bit about it now. It's just as I started to become more aware of, let's say, soul consciousness at an early age, I ironically started to hear the cries of the wounded in very distinct ways. That is, muffled cries and sobs in various states of consciousness. And first time I became aware of this, I started to hear things in my dreams. I started to see things in my dreams that I just, I was convinced, it's just in a different realm, a different location, as it were. But as a boy, I didn't know what to do with it. But as I got older, the lessons came and I learned, what hearing the cries of the wounded are all about. Because this awareness, I believe, was not by accident. In fact, my Native American Indian teacher, who I think I shared the story at one point, pointed out my cut finger in his blood and ancestors lesson to me. He also awakened me further on this journey to be able to release the souls that have been trapped by trauma and the land that holds that kind of energy. And to accomplish this, it was no longer sufficient for me to just simply hear the cries of the wounded. But it was time for me to visit the actual physical places that witnessed these crimes against humanity. And it was also time to transform the traumatic energies and heal the land and release these souls back to God. So that is next week's topic, Vaya con Dios, go with God. Well, earlier in the broadcast, we were talking about being in a liminal space, a place of transition, a place of ambiguity, a place of just not knowing what's coming. And, basically a liminal space takes the concept of, let's say, standing at a threshold and, just we're not ready to walk through yet. We realize it is a time of transition, metaphorically speaking. It's a time of ambiguity, and also it can be a time of waiting. But in spiritual terms, it also becomes a time of growth or a learning, lesson that we need to understand, or maybe even a spiritual transformation if the person experiencing it embraces the opportunity. Indeed, we do have a choice as to how we're going to live and move and function being in a liminal space. And these liminal spaces are very much part of our lives because if we ever find ourselves being in a liminal space and we just wish that we didn't have these times of transitions, we certainly would stop growing or we wouldn't be challenged anymore and we just would stop developing to our fullest potential. But in a sense, moving us out of our comfort zones and into a fear zone. And this is where our sense of vulnerability can really take hold of us. That, if truth be told, I mean, let's be honest with each other, we would want to stay in our comfort zones for the rest of our lives. It's this psychological state in which things feel very familiar to us and we are at ease and we tell ourselves, I'm in control of my environment and I'm experiencing low levels of anxiety and stress and this is nice. Because in this zone, there's a steady level of performance, a steady level of expectation. And this is possible. And like I said, this is where we feel safe and in control. However, there are times simply by going through transitions that we find ourselves thrust out of the comfort zone and into the fear zone and then eventually into the learning zone, whereby we deal with new challenges or perhaps we acquire new skills. And then in doing so, this immediately moves us even further into, let's say, the growth zone, where we can set new goals or we want to pursue a new purpose and direction in our lives. And it's also the place in which we finally believe that we are living out our dreams. So let's bring back in finding resiliency in these liminal spaces. Today, you know, although stress has become a familiar word, its effects have influenced us on a physical, emotional, psychological, and even a spiritual level. And add to our stress an experience that is sudden and dramatic, and it overwhelms our sense of well-being. And again, this is the making of a traumatic experience. And like I said before, these experiences can be life-threatening. They could be real or imagined, and they can certainly knock the wind right out of us, physically, emotionally, and spiritually speaking. But the length of time it takes for us to get, shall we say, back on our feet and replenish our resiliency and rebuild our faith and our philosophical perspectives, speaks to the intensity of the traumatic experience. And for example, we have something called the acute stress reaction. It's a transient response to overwhelming physical and emotional stress that typically diminishes within a few hours or just simply a few days. For example, we all may have experienced acute stress reaction when, let's say, we need to complete a task before a deadline. Let's pick on filing taxes, okay? Or let's say if you're a student out there, completing your homework assignments or cramming for exams or completing job-related projects. We can certainly just find, times if we're behind the eight ball, so to speak, our hearts just begin to race and we experience some sort of acute stress reaction. And other examples of this may include being in a minor car accident or having interpersonal difficulties at work, or let's say the students having academic problems at school. And depending on these times and depending on our level of resiliency, we may experience, let's say, the rising heart rates or the sweating or feeling dazed or shallow breathing or even difficulty concentrating. However, once the situation has been resolved and perhaps through the additional help of a family or community support, our symptoms of this acute stress reaction typically diminish. Okay, if you've ever had a minor car accident, you can get worked up pretty well with that. Just simply, first of all, is anybody hurt? Am I hurt? Did I hurt somebody else? Did I kill somebody else? And we realize it was just a minor fender bender. And, insurance information is exchanged and police are notified and it's all good. Things will be taken care of. And when we get home and we realize that it could have been much worse than what we experienced, then we're able to relax. Then we're able to take a deep breath. Then we're able to reassure ourselves that, okay, everybody's fine. This is an inconvenience, if you want to put it that way. But still, having an acute stress reaction is not meant to sustain us for long periods of time. Okay? But nonetheless, there are times when, despite our ability to cope, exposure to real or perceived life-threatening events do overwhelm us for longer periods. And again, acute stress disorder just typically develops within a month of exposure to some traumatic event, let's say war or rape or sexual violence, molestation, sexual abuse, physical harm, such as an attack or kidnapping or, let's say, being taken hostage or terrorist attacks, torture, bombings, relentless natural disasters, and life-threatening accidents. And furthermore, our first responders also experience acute stress disorder when they are dispatched first to a scene of an accident or to collect, shall we say, human remains. And for the most part, symptoms such as flashbacks or maybe nightmares, emotional distress, impairment, an altered sense of reality, hyperarousal, and so forth, as soon as 3 days following a traumatic experience, which makes it very difficult then to remain hopeful being in a liminal space, being in that time of transition with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of ambiguity. Well, this change in how we begin to approach the liminal space shows up first in how we tell stories. And this change in how we tell, especially traumatic stories, indicates a transformational healing in all relationships that has occurred and then even has the potential to exceed time and space. And, you know, more than just recounting facts or dates or figures, it's our stories that carry with them elements of healing and grace and hope for not just ourselves or our family, but really for all of humanity. And ironically, this is one thing that has always been a key piece in sustaining cultural or generational identity. That's storytelling. And as people tell their stories, we find that it's a means of preserving memories of, let's say, loved ones, as well as reinforcing a sense of personal uniqueness. In counseling others, I often struggle with being in their liminal space and, let's say, their traumatic experiences. But at the same time, I've noticed that when people have not been able to transform the negative energy around such tragic events, their stories are often told the same way each time, every time. Okay. And I will share with you that as a boy, I remember listening to the same stories, family stories at picnics or holidays or other family outings and gatherings. And I've heard these stories so often that by the time I was a teenager, I could recite them word for word. However, now with the benefit of hindsight, I also understand that not only did these details not change, but also the storyteller's interpretation and attitudes remain the same. And this is after years and years and decades of the same stories being shared. In fact, one of the things I picked up on early on was that there was always an underlying tone of helplessness or bitterness or sadness or resentment that drove how the story was being told. And ironically, it was almost as if the story was not being told correctly if such negative emotions were absent. Because from the time that we are born till the time when we leave this earth, we are faced with one liminal space after another. And our understanding of being in a time of transition or liminal space is often placed within a story, even if the story has yet to be fully written. Now, from being read bedtime stories to reading books on our own to watching shows and listening to others, stories often provide us the context as well as the mental images for making sense of life. And Australian-born physician, psychotherapist, pioneer of individual psychology, Alfred Adler, he believed that stories not only provided some form or structure to our earliest memories, but also these stories became a blueprint for how we live our lives in relation to others. And perhaps one reason why our psychological, emotional, and spiritual healing then is so elusive is due to this misperception that we believe that we are separate from our problems. We're separate from our stories. And in fact, it's the other way around, that when we tell our stories, we share our stories with others, they are just merely extensions of where we are in life and how we remember certain events. But part of finding our resiliency and healing with a liminal space or a transition not only involves telling our stories, but also involves reclaiming our empowerment to rewrite our stories that are now filled with life-empowering and filled with very affirming words or feelings. And we do not achieve this empowerment from, let's say, an embellished, delusional view that nicely ties up stories in a bow. Or shall we say, they lived happily ever after. However, our stories are now told from a healthier perspective, and we certainly come from a place of healing when we're able to do this. Now, granted, we are not able to recall every experience, but for those moments that do stand out to us, they often serve as our unconscious logic about how we see ourselves or our relationships with others, even the motivation for our behavior today. And as an example, a useful tool for understanding how our personal healing mirrors our storytelling perspectives can also be seen in what Alfred Adler described as a lifestyle assessment. And among other accounts of our birth order and family constellation that he used, this lifestyle assessment includes recalling our earliest memories in story form. And people typically are able to recall two or three earliest memories, and perhaps a memory from later childhood or one memory from adolescence, and then, you know, just need to be able to tell a memory from early adulthood. And from each of these memories, people tell or they journal their stories with as much detail as possible, as much as they remember. Then, after each memory, they complete the following open-ended phrases from the perspective of how old they were in the story. So it goes something like this. Let's say, as a four-year-old, I am whatever. Others are whatever. The world is fill in the blank. And therefore, I will, and so forth. Now, an adult sharing an earliest memory, let's say from a birthday party at age four, might remember how disappointed she felt when her favorite aunt was not there to watch her blow out the candles on the cake. And from this perspective of that four-year-old, she might complete these phrases this way. I am sad. Others are singing. The world is noisy, and therefore, I will blow out my candles. Now, other subsequent memories from this person might then follow a similar interpretation of experiences that form, you know, his or her behavioral pattern as seen through, let's say, her eyes of a later child or adolescent or early adult. And perhaps she might come to the conclusion at some point in her life that since others don't seem to notice me or care how I feel, I will go along with others and I will do what they want me to do, hence the blowing out of the candles. However, as these perspectives of insignificance and unworthiness are healed and transformed as she is able to work through these issues, the interpretation of recalling earliest memories change into her healthier storytelling. So let's return to the memory of her birthday party. The four-year-old who did not realize at the time, let's say, that her aunt was unable to see her blow out her candles, not because she didn't care, but because she stopped to help another person involved in a car accident, and she was actually holding pressure on a deep cut until the ambulance arrived. However, the earliest memory of that birthday party was internalized at a young age as, like, I'm not important, so I have to ignore my feelings and go along with the crowd. But now, when this four-year-old is an adult and has healed from this negative self-talk, a healthier perspective is now integrated into her earliest memory. So as a result, you know, as an adult, she can still recall her birthday party. However, not only does she tell the story differently based on a more thorough picture of, let's say, when, where, how, and with whom these earliest beliefs developed, but also her present relationships are even healthier. For example, she might return to that birthday party and say, well, I'm sad because my favorite aunt was not there to see me blow out my candles, but now I understand that she needed to help someone else. Others are singing because they did not know what happened to my aunt and not that they were insensitive to my feelings. The world is noisy and sometimes dangerous, but thank God there are people who stop to help others in need. And therefore, I will also do what I need to do in the moment without dismissing my feelings. I still got a hug and a kiss from my aunt, and so did that injured person from the car accident. She saved a life that day. Oh, and by the way, did I tell you that it was because of my aunt that I went into nursing? So you can see how stories change, you know, not to embellish or not to make the story sound better, but we tell the story from a healthier place, and it's a more positive outlook, a stronger understanding. And so this healthier perspective often forms in a greater sense of our identity, as well as a deeper sense of compassion and empathy and grace towards others. And healing from trauma also has this effect, especially when we find ourselves in these liminal spaces. And the healing occurs within the greater context of generations, and people tell their stories much differently from a healthier and, shall we say, a more holistic perspective. Well, the reason why we can tell our stories differently is because much of the healing involves becoming aware of the former negative perceptions of self-talk that just no longer serve us. You know, we recognize how these cognitive schemas have been just simply draining our energy or distorting our perceptions and diminishing our potential for enjoying healthier relationships. In fact, when we replace these stories with more, shall we say, more transformative and life-giving perspectives, a starburst of energy heals all generations across time and space. And the beauty of these earliest memories is how they change over time, not in a sense of, you know, making it up as we go, like reminiscing about the good old days or a fish story tale about the one that got away, but rather understanding how we tell our stories differently from a healthier place, a place of hope, a place of peace. And when we are able to do this, we no longer fear the liminal spaces in our lives, but we see them as opportunities to tap into the very best parts of ourselves, the very best parts that we can give to be fully in relationships. Well, I want to leave you with another quote from one of my other favorite authors, Henry Nouwen, and regarding a liminal space. He says that you can tell your story from the place where it no longer dominates you. You can speak about it with a certain distance and see it as the way to your present freedom. And this is what being in a liminal space is all about. We no longer fear the liminal spaces, but we look at them as great opportunities to explore perhaps untapped potential in us, or to draw out even more of ourselves to be in healthier relationships. So I would encourage you, the next time you find yourself in a liminal space, to look at it as opportunities for change and growth, to look at it as opportunities to find greater healing in your life, instead of looking at liminal spaces as something negative and uncertain and filled with anxiety and so forth. That certainly has the potential to create those things in us. However, as we tell our stories, even though our stories are still being written per se, as we are in a liminal space, we can still come across hopeful, filled with resiliency and confidence that we will make very good decisions for the sake of not only ourselves and our families, but for all of humanity. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And until we talk to each other again, please be safe, behave yourselves, and take care. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio.